And our co-chair is going to be here in just moments, but we do have a time constraint with one of our presenters, so that's why I want to just go ahead and get us started. Today's Wednesday, February 27th. Members present at this time: Representative Rauscher, Representative Rasmussen, Representative Tuck, Representative Hannon, Representative Tallarico, our Vice Chair, Representative Hopkins, myself, Representative Tarr. Please let the record reflect that we do have a quorum to conduct business. If we could please ask folks to silence their cell phones as we get started, we sure appreciate that. Our co-chair, Representative John Lincoln, thank you. We're just starting because we have a time crunch. Assisting us today for our recording secretary is Ms. Debbie Tillinghast. She's been our great recording secretary for a number of years. Thank you. And our LIO moderator, Doug Bridges. Thank you very much. This afternoon, we're going to be hearing a department overview of the Department of Natural Resources by Deputy Commissioner Brent Goodrum and Deputy Commissioner Sarah Longan. And it's the second individual that has a time crunch, so maybe we'll try in this schedule to accommodate that, whoever wants to present first. We are going to take questions throughout of it, throughout the presentation. In person, we're also joined by Fabian Peter Contest, the Director of Division of Support Services. Thank you. And additionally, we have Department of Natural Resources division directors online to answer questions. So I think we have those folks here showing up. Marty Parsons, Ken Papp, Chantel Wash, and Jim Beckham, Chris Mesh, and I think that's everybody here. Yep. So we have those folks online to help us out, too. So before we get started, I just want to take 1 second. When we had our meeting the other day, Representative Rasmussen wasn't here, so we just went around and introduced ourselves. If you wouldn't mind introducing yourself and just shared a little bit about why we were interested in being on this committee.
My name is Representative Sarah Rasmussen. I represent District 22, which is the Sand Lake area in Anchorage over by the airport. I come from the private sector. I'm a residential appraiser, and I have seen the current impacts of the economic downturn that we've had in my profession, and I believe that the best path forward is through responsible resource development, which is my primary reason for sitting on this committee.
And then if you have a staff member, if you want to introduce them.
Yep, and I have Kristen Walker from my office here.
Excellent. Welcome. Thank you. Okay, if we could have the two deputy commissioners please come join us. And actually, before we get started, we do have another new staff member here today that we should introduce.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The committee staff, Abel Hobson-Subli, wasn't with us in our first meeting, but Abel is here today. Welcome, Abel.
So he and Thatcher will be the primary committee aides, so I'm sure you'll be hearing from them a lot. So thank you so much. If you would please state your name for the record. And then what we like to do is take the questions at the end of each slide, just so you can get through your slide before we have our questions. So that's what we'll try and do.
Great. Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Brent Goodrum. I'm Deputy Commissioner of the Department. And on behalf of Commissioner Corey Feige, we're very pleased to be in front of you today, giving in the presentation and overview of the department. I'm joined here at the table by Deputy Commissioner Sarah Longan, who will introduce herself in a second. You mentioned before we've got Director Fabian Peter Contest. We also have Associate Director Kyle Moselle in the room with us, and directors in the on the phone, as you had mentioned. That's given our desire to also be good fiscal stewards of the resources given to us. So they will be following along and available for more deep dives into questions that folks may have. I do want to bring to your attention real quick, the department every year puts out a program guide, and I know it's been made available, but I know there's new members to this committee, and it's got very detailed information on all the programs within the department, and so we're not getting into this today, but I'm just reminding you that it's a tool that we've provided and made available, and there's a lot of great information in there, so that's for your use and questions as we go forward. Deputy Commissioner Logan will kind of start us out since she does have a time obligation, and she'll cover her portion of the department, and then I will follow up once she's completed her remarks. So thank you for allowing us to be here today.
And thank you. Just as you get started, I want to welcome Representative Sponholz, who's joined us. Thank you.
Thank you. Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to present today. I am Deputy Commissioner Sarah Longen from the Department of Natural Resources for the record. Our first slide is an outline of the presentation we will be sharing today. We will begin by providing an overview of the four divisions that I oversee, shown here on the right-hand side of the organization chart. Before we do that, just for some background awareness that I'm quite familiar, you are all familiar with, is Alaska is a very large state, and we are fortunate to have world-class resources. We're proud to be more than twice the size of Texas. Impressively, we're larger than all but 18 sovereign nations. We have more coastline than all other 49 states combined. The map on the lower right-hand side of the slide shows state, federal, and native corporation land ownership. The federal government manages more than 200 million acres in our state. The state owns and manages approximately 100 million acres of uplands, 60 million acres of tidelands, shorelands, and submerged lands, as well as 40,000 miles of coastline. There are 44 million acres of Native Corporation lands throughout the state. Not only is our state large, as I had mentioned, we are fortunate to have really world-class resources. The North Slope Basin was recently classified as a super basin by IHS Markit, and there's more undiscovered, potentially recoverable oil than any other Arctic nation on the North Slope. This includes an estimated 40 billion barrels of conventional oil and an estimated roughly 200 trillion cubic feet of conventional natural gas. There's also untapped unconventional resource potential, including tens of billions of barrels of heavy and shale oil, viscous oil, and hundreds of trillions of cubic feet of shale and tight gas, as well as gas hydrates. The Cook Inlet remains a significant and important contributor to production today, and also remains a significant source of undiscovered resources, including 19 trillion cubic feet of natural gas, 60 million barrels of oil, and 46 million barrels of natural gas liquids. Compared to most other basins, Alaska is relatively underexplored, with 500 exploration wells on the North Slope compared to Wyoming's 19,000. The first division we will provide an overview for is the Division of Oil and Gas. There's 98 positions led by Director Chantal Walsh. DOG manages lands for oil, gas, and geothermal exploration and development in a fair and transparent manner to maximize the prudent use of resources for the greatest benefit of all Alaskans. The division also facilitates safe and environmentally conscious operations and maintenance of common carrier pipelines. The Division of Oil and Gas has a large responsibility, and they are a key player of generating significant revenues for the state by conducting lease sales, collecting royalties, authorizing oil and gas activities, and again, regulating common carrier pipelines on state land. DOG also provides commercial analysis, economic modeling, financial risk assessments, audits, and other professional services to ensure the state receives maximum value for our oil and gas resources.
Yes, Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On the common carrier pipelines, which are some of the largest ones that the state oversees?
Madam Chair, Representative Tuck, TAPS. The Trans-Alaska Pipeline System is by far the largest common carrier pipeline. There are other pipelines statewide that are regulated under this same common carrier status.
And if I may, Madam Chair, I know TAPS is the obvious one, but can you share some other large ones?
Through the Chair, Representative Tuck, Point Thompson's project that they brought in to develop recently includes what they call the Point Thompson Export Pipeline, and that is a common carrier pipeline as well.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And I just want to ask, on this mission statement that's here, is this any different than prior to the new administration, or is it just that you wanted to be clear? Because I'm not remembering if we saw the mission statement before, so I just wondered if it's been updated in any way, or if just you want to introduce that as part of your presentation.
Madam Chair, the only change that I'm familiar with is the inclusion of facilitate safe and conscious operations of the common carrier pipelines. Okay. And that's because of a structural change that we've made lately. The state pipeline coordinator section used to be autonomous, still part of our department, but we have co-located this section and it's now included in the Division of Oil and Gas. We're doing that to gain efficiencies and make sure that there's knowledge sharing across both teams.
Thank you. Representative Hannon.
Thank you. Representative Tuck's questions now have me thinking. Are there common carrier pipelines outside of the North Slope besides TAPS?
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, yes. And if it's helpful, we could provide the committee a map of all common carrier pipelines throughout the state.
Please do, and we'll share that with everyone. Anyone else? Okay, please continue.
So I wanted to share some of the major accomplishments the Division of Oil and Gas achieved in 2008, and they've been very busy and productive, so I'm just going to highlight a few of these accomplishments. They held 5 area-wide lease sales, resulting in over $20 million in bonus bids and more than 200,000 acres leased. They initiated the release of seismic and well data sets for oil and gas exploration projects that received tax credits. They are now preparing the production forecast previously prepared by the Department of Revenue's contractor. The royalty section offers an important core service, and in 2018, they issued 4 royalty net profit share lease audits and 4 state royalty audits, collecting over $74 million, including interest. There are many administrative functions the division is responsible for that are key to maintaining responsible oil and gas activities throughout the state, including administering approximately 2,000 leases and licenses and also covering nearly 5.3 million acres. Other administrative functions that are important include, in 2018, the division processed 65 plan of operation amendments for activities both on the North Slope and in the Cook Inlet.
We have a question here from Representative Sponholz.
Thank you, Chair Tarr. You describe that there was 4 audits that were done in 2018. How does this compare sort of historically with the number of audits that we've done annually?
Through the chair, Representative Sponholz, I don't have that data for our past audits, but I know that our division tracks historically what those audits look like. If it's helpful, we can follow up and provide that information.
I would like that, yeah. I'd like to see sort of a trend over the last few, you know, maybe 5 years to sort of get a sense of productivity in that area.
Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I didn't take that one bullet point as being 2018. I was wondering on the 4 royalty audits and the 4 state royalty audits, what years those were?
Through the chair, Representative Tuck, it's my understanding that that was for 2018. If permissible, I'd like to call upon Director Chantal Walsh just to add any clarifying information if necessary.
Absolutely. Ms. Walsh?
This is, for the record, this is Director Chantal Walsh. Through the chair, the audits that were issued this last year were from years past, and we can include that in that 5-year follow-up that was requested. Okay. I don't know the specifics of the years.
Okay. May I
follow up?
Mm-hmm. So how current are we with our audits? I guess would be the next question. If you don't have that available, to please answer for the committee as well.
Director Walsh, did you hear that question?
I did, through the chair. This is Director Walsh again, and I can include that information, but we're relatively current. We're looking at anywhere in the last 5 years that we're auditing back into.
And this is Representative Tarr. I just want to clarify, when you're talking about the audits you're working on, you're talking about these particular royalty or the profit share lease audits, as opposed to any of the audits that are related to severance tax that would be done through Department of Revenue, correct?
This is Chantal Walsh. Yes, that is correct.
Okay. And so the information we'll get just for committee members will be for those the ones that you often hear about related to the tech, you know, the production tax, our Department of Revenue. And so if there's interest in those as well, then we can follow up and get folks info on that too. Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
We'll move on to describe the Office of Project Management and Permitting. They go by OPUMP, which is a lot simpler to say. This is a relatively small office located in the DNR Commissioner's office. The team of 13 people are led by Director Faith Martineau. You'll see that they have a little over $6 million in their budget, but a very small portion of that, less than $1 million, is actually unrestricted general funds, and that's because they operate under a reimbursable services model. Their mission is to coordinate multi-agency regulatory reviews and authorizations while collaboratively engaging federal agencies on land use planning, project reviews, and policy initiatives to maintain and enhance the state's economy, quality of life, and maximize the value of Alaska's vast natural resources. The OPUMP model is unique to Alaska and offers a level of assurance to companies investing in Alaska that permit reviews are robust, transparent, and on time. OPUMP supports private industry, regulators, and the general public by implementing a one-stop shop, multi-agency permit coordination to secure, again, consistent, defensible, transparent, and timely permit decisions.
And I guess if I could just ask, as you go through these with the mission, if there's anything that's changed or new, but just to help us understand if that means, you know, different direction, that would be helpful.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'll read the slides verbatim, or the words on the slides verbatim. But for your awareness and mine also, these mission statements, it's my understanding they have not changed significantly other than the minor change I made for the Division of Oil and Gas.
Okay, that's really helpful. Then don't worry about it, though.
Okay.
Thank you. Did someone have a question? Was there a question? Okay.
I got a comment.
Oh, sure.
Not only is it probably easier to say, but it's funner to hear OPUMP.
Through the chair, Representative Tuck, thank you. I agree, and we'll take that into consideration moving forward.
Please continue. Thank you.
So for OPUMP, major accomplishments include the ongoing coordinated federal review, as well as coordinating state permit efforts and regulatory compliance for virtually most, if not all, major projects, both on the oil and gas and mining side. I won't read all of the projects listed here on the slide, but for oil and gas, you'll see that the OPUMP coordination model is being applied for the Nanushuk project or the Pikka development that I'm sure you're hearing about. We're working closely to support ConocoPhillips Alaska for their Greater Moose's Tooth projects, and that's plural. Also, their Willow Master Development Plan in the National Petroleum Reserve, Alaska. And we're busy working on many other important oil and gas projects. On the mining side, the large management permit team is really working on all operating state mines, all mines that are operating in the state, as well as those under review and being proposed. And those include Donlin, Red Dog, Fort Knox, Greens Creek, the Ambler Mining District and Industrial Access Project as well. For the projects that have an asterisk beside them, these five projects that are being coordinated by OPUMP received a final environmental impact statement, or EIS, back in 2018. And I can attest that that really requires a lot of coordination resources just to make sure that we're supporting our federal colleagues and that we're also coordinating all of the state permits from the multiple state departments so that we're synchronized on time and our goal is to really minimize surprises. OPUMP continues to engage with federal agencies to advance state interests during really most and all of the major federal planning efforts. And these include the Coastal Plain Oil and Gas Leasing Program, the NPRA Integrated Activity Plan. We work closely with the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, or BOEM, as they go through their federal planning process for the Outer Continental Shelf leasing plans. We work closely with the Bureau of Land Management as they embark upon their resource management planning, or RMP, process. And the three major plans under development currently are for Central Yukon, Bering Sea Western Interior, and the Tongass roadless rulemaking, which is actually through the Forest Service, of course. OPUMP continues to partner with the North Slope Borough on a strategic transportation and resources planning effort. In 2008, that largely consisted of understanding and committing to stakeholder engagement, maintaining and developing a digital project library, as well as conducting a baseline health assessment and initial phases of terrain unit mapping.
Representative Rasmussen has a question.
Thank you, Chair Tarr. What's the typical time frame from start to final EIS, specifically with the five projects that were just issued this year, or 2018, I guess?
Through the chair, Representative Rasmussen, I wish you can attend the next hearing I'm going to in House Finances. It's a good question, and we're happy to answer. I'm going to start by sharing a recent development. The leadership in the federal government currently has been expecting the federal agencies to keep the National Environmental Planning NEPA process for EISs to roughly 1 year. The projects that we just identified here were probably undergoing NEPA prior to this federal administration, and an average time that we've seen typically for oil and gas projects in the state can be 3 years. We've seen NEPA take longer than that when there are complex issues and when, you know, in DNR's perspective, not everything is going well and requires delays in the timing for NEPA. So I think the answer for projects moving forward under the current federal administration is, again, the federal government is expected to do NEPA in roughly 1 year.
Quick follow-up. Mm-hmm. So can you estimate per year how much money the state would lose in royalty from lack of production or, you know, kind of delaying the process? Is that something you quantified?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Rasmussen, it is something that we could probably develop to better understand, but time lost, whether it's through NEPA or whether it's through federal or state permitting, means less royalties to the state in most cases. We've never looked at a project specifically, but generally we would assume that that is the case. And we are encouraged, however, that the federal process is going in a shorter timeline, and there's still robust public and stakeholder collaboration and input throughout those compressed and shorter timelines.
Representative Hannon.
So through the chair, I guess I'm confused when you say the time lost would reduce our royalties, because my perception is here's the ore body. Once you're permitted to take it out, we're going to draw the royalties. It would delay us receiving the royalties, but you indicated we would lose those royalties. So I'm confused.
Madam Chair, Representative Hannon, to clarify my statement, a time delay in bringing projects online I see as an opportunity cost for those resources being developed and those royalties being made available.
Okay. Please continue. And I know we are going to have you just for about five more minutes, I think. Okay. And so we'll try to just get through as much as we can before you have to leave. So,
Madam Chair, I appreciate that. We've got just two more to go.
Okay, great.
The Division of Geological and Geophysical Surveys, or DGGS, they're a team of 45 people led by Director Steve Masterman. Their mission is to determine the potential of Alaska land for production of metals, minerals, fuels, and geothermal resources. The locations and supplies of groundwater and construction material, and they have the important task of identifying the potential geologic hazards to buildings, roads, bridges, and other installations. The division collects, analyzes, and publishes data, maps, and report that stimulates oil and gas mineral development, as well as identifying geologic hazards. A very important function of this division is to manage the Geologic Materials Center, or GMC, that makes Alaska's invaluable collection of cores, samples, and data available to developers and the public. On the right-hand side of this slide, you'll see that the GMC played an important part in allowing the division to reach some pretty impressive accomplishments in 2018, including hosting over 1,300 individuals at the Materials Center and holding workshops educating private industry, the public, at the same facility. DGGS also acquired a LIDAR instrument and began LIDAR collection, its survey methodology, They conducted petroleum geology field work on the North Slope, including in the Anwar 1002 area. They began a sand and gravel assessment of the NPRA. DNR views this as really pretty important as development is going further from state lands and crossing into NPRA. It's essential for us as land managers, the federal government as land managers also, to really understand what those sand and gravel assessments and resources are and hopefully where they are. DGGS established additional erosion and flood monitoring sites in western Alaska, and they conducted geologic mapping in the Richardson and Tanana Cross areas for gold and copper gold systems. The Mental Health Trust Land Office, their mission is to protect and enhance the value of Alaska Mental Health Trust lands, including minerals, coal, oil and gas, timber, and real estate, while maximizing revenues from those lands over time to support mental health services. There's a team of 19 people led by Executive Director Wynn Menefee. You'll notice that their overall budget in fiscal year 2019 is $4.5 million, and zero of that is from unrestricted general fund sources. Again, TLO is responsible for managing the land and resources owned by the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority. TLO's mission is to generate revenue for trust beneficiaries from land sales and leasing, including also real estate investment and development, timber sales, and other resource development. In 2018, the Trust Land Office generated over $11 million to fund programs for roughly 85,000 Alaska Mental Health Trust beneficiaries. And over $5 million of this was from land sales, leases, and easements. $1.8 million was from real estate investments and leases, and $730,000, was from oil, gas, and mineral royalties. They work to explore Icy Cape to better define mineral resources for future development, and they continue to focus and work hard on a really critical Forest Service land exchange to swap 20,000 acres of valuable land. That is the completion of the four divisions that I oversee, and if permissible by the committee, this is when I would like to depart. I'm obligated to testify to House Finance.
Yes, of course we're going to say yes. But I just wanted to cover, thank you because you did that at record speed, that the follow-up items were a map of the common carrier pipelines and then the audit trends over the last 5 years, I think were the two items that people requested. So if you get those to us, then we'll certainly share those with everyone. And I hope, because I'm so proud to have the GMC in my district, that maybe we could do another tour sometime in the future for anyone who hasn't been there. We made good use of the old Sam's Club with that facility. So thank you. And sure, of course, excuse yourself, and I hope you have a good experience in finance.
Thank you.
And great. Then if you want to continue.
Yes, yeah, great. Good afternoon. Brent Goodham, Deputy Commissioner.
Oh, pardon me. I apologize. Vice Chair Hopkins had something he wanted to.
Thank you. Yeah, I just want to roll back a little bit and ask Director Steve Masterman of the Division of Geological and Geophysical Surveys. Is it safe to say that DGGS helps to take some of the risk out of exploration for oil and gas companies looking for areas on the slope using technology and surveys out there to help bring some of those fields online by taking out that initial risk of exploration?
I'm not sure if Mr. Masterman is online.
I believe that Ken Papp.
Mr. Papp, okay. Let me just, okay, there we go. Thank you. Mr. Papp, are you available?
Yes, this is Kenneth Papp, Deputy Director for DGGS, for the record.
Thank you. Did you hear the question?
Yes, I did.
Okay, okay. If you have an answer, that'd be wonderful. Thank you.
Yes. Representatives, through the chair, we absolutely take some of that risk from the industry. We are pretty proud of the field work that we've accomplished over the last several years and what we hope to accomplish, especially up in the North Slope area over the next several years. In fact, we proudly collaborate with other geologists with the Division of Oil and Gas and Anchorage USGS staff members. So our hope, of course, is to focus on the Brookian Formation and the North Slope foothills. And, of course, these played critical roles, as you know, and the
Uh-oh.
We're waiting with bated breath. Oh, okay. Mr. Papp, if you can hear us, we lost you there for a moment, mid-sentence.
Okay, I'm sorry, my phone was recently unmuted, so where did you folks lose me?
About 30 seconds ago.
Oh, dear.
I guess I can.
Okay.
Not too long before that.
Just to recap, we're pretty proud of what we've accomplished and what we would like to accomplish up in the North Slope. We work with geologists in the Division of Oil and Gas and USGS Anchorage Office, and we did play a critical role in the Brookian and Nanushik-hosted formations up in the North Slope regarding the recent Pikka and Horseshoe and Willow oil discoveries. We have direct, phrasing and, words of praise from various folks in the oil industry from the work that we have done. So we are proud to get that information out there to industry.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that work that you do and helping bring those resources online and moving it along. Are you also looking at developments in the Cook Inlet area as well recently?
Representative, through the chair, this is Kenneth Papp again. We, in the past several years, have completed field work in the western portion of Cook Inlet. And within the next year, we hope to produce a compilation map of 3 years' worth of work that we have completed on that western part of Cook Inlet, starting with the Red Glacier area. And that will come out soon. I think through obviously activity that we have seen in the North Slope, we are sort of refocusing our effort up in that area. So I think we're kind of ramping down activity in Cook Inlet. However, we're always open to possibilities and helping out industry.
Excellent. Thank you very much. How can we help you guys do more of that work to help us bring more online and explore some of those more areas out there and enhance exploration on the North Slope?
Representative, through the chair, this is Kenneth Papp again for the record. I believe, as you know, logistics and field work in Alaska are very challenging. We do what we can with the money that we are provided. Hiring more people to go out into the field, and obviously paying for logistics like helicopter support, fuel, that sort of thing. All of those types of components of the field work are obviously quite expensive. And so we basically do the best we can with our given budget. And I think that might be somewhere if you could help, and we could obviously do more, assuming we had more people to do the work.
Thank you, Mr. Papp.
We'll have to come back to that when we get into the budget discussion. Thank you, Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If you don't mind explaining what a Nanushik workshop is.
Mr. Papp, did you hear that question for you?
Yes, I did. I'm sorry, there's a bit of a delay. Representative, through the chair, the Nanushik workshop is actually a workshop that was hosted at the Geologic Material Center in Eagle River, and Nanushik is the name of a rock formation along the Colville River that basically has very, very impressive oil and gas reservoir potential. And that particular formation is related to the recent discoveries in the Pikka, Horseshoe, and Willow oil units.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mm-hmm. I just have to do one minor correction that it's in Russian Jack, not Eagle River.
Yes.
Um, please continue. I guess we're over to you now.
Sure. I'm sure for Ken, old habits die hard. I think Ken spent a number of years out in Eagle River. And so anyway, thank you, Madam Chair. Alaska's mineral resources are incredible. We're in the top 10 of the world, not just the United States, but in the world for a number of resources. And as I look around this room, many of your districts host of many of these. Coal, if Alaska were its own entity, would rank second in the world with 17% of the world's coal. Gold, 8% of the world's gold, and fourth most in the world. Zinc, 5% of the world's zinc, and seventh most in the world. So based upon those numbers, I mean, Alaska is an incredible resource for minerals. Within a recent 2017 Fraser Institute report, Alaska ranked fifth for mineral potential and 10th for investment attractiveness out of 91 jurisdictions. So with numbers like that, if you desire to be in the minerals business, you need to be in Alaska.
Representative Sponholz has a question.
Thank you, Chair Tarr. I actually don't have a question. I just have a comment. As we're looking at this page and the resource potential for minerals in the state of Alaska, I think it's important for us all to keep in mind that the university is a key resource for us as we look at developing these resources, that the university has both, you know, professional academic expertise in these areas. I worked with the geology program at the University of Alaska Anchorage at UAF, and their faculty helped do research and exploration projects throughout the state and also train the workforce in both engineering, geology, and in some of the more process technology jobs specifically, that we need to make sure that our universities have the tools that they need to continue to support this work, or else we'll continue to be sort of a banana republic where we import, you know, talent and expertise and we export our resources to the rest of the world, which isn't good for our economy. Just a comment.
Thank you. And actually, here in Juneau at UAS, there's the mining program there, and maybe there'll be an opportunity for us to check that out.
Right. Many of the employees within DNR have, you know, gone to school at UAF or UAA or UAS, and so wonderful institutions that do great things for our state. So thank you very much. The Division of Mining, Land, and Water is one of the foundational divisions within the department. Its activities and functions interact with almost all the other divisions within the department. The division is responsible for managing more than 160 million acres, which is a land base close to about the size of California plus most of Oregon. They do this with about 207 employees, and they are capably led by Director Marty Parsons. Many of the activities that they're responsible for deal with acquiring of land from the federal government, still from our statehood land entitlement. They do permitting, they do land planning, disposals of land either through land sales or municipal entitlements. Stewardship and reclamation responsibilities are all things that they are involved in. In 2018, the division generated $27.2 million worth of revenues for authorizations of use state land and waters. They've continued their work on the North Slope Area Plan, which is important to municipal entitlements to the North Slope Borough. They issued a preliminary decision for the Haines Municipal Entitlement of about 1,500 acres. The division is also the platting authority for the for those lands that are in the unorganized borough, and so they've done a lot of work there. And in January of 2018, we worked closely with U.S. Coast Guard, DEC, the port director and harbor master out in Dutch Harbor, dealing with an abandoned and derelict vessel, the fishing vessel Akatan, and that took a lot of hard work to help address that important issue out there. The group also works to continue to press access issues and assertion defense of state title. And in 2018, the division confirmed state title to submerged lands beneath the eight water bodies you see listed there. A lot of good work continues to be done on that front. On the North Slope, they have an oil and gas team out of their Fairbanks office that authorized approximately 196 miles of ice roads, which are important for activities on the North Slope, as well as 283 miles of snow roads and 60 acres of ice pads during the 2017-18 season. Within their land sales program, they sold 217 parcels just under 2,000 acres for over 2.4 million acre or dollars, as well as completed inspections on a number of jurisdictional dams throughout the state.
And we did have a question on slide 13. Apologies that we didn't get to it fast enough with Representative Rasmussen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. When you were discussing the federal land acquisition, do you have any idea what we're looking at as far as acquisition in 2019, 2020, kind of a little bit of a forecast for that?
Madam Chair, through the Chair, Representative Rasmussen, the state is still entitled to about 5.3 million acres from the federal government from our statehood land entitlement in 1959. The pace at which the state is able to bring lands in depend on which lands are available. Several of the federal planning efforts that the federal government are currently under in the Central Yukon Plan, that area includes the Public Land Order 5150, which is a TAPS corridor, and that area has a lot of very highly valuable land to the state that the state has sought for a number of decades to bring into ownership. We're being told that we have to wait until they complete that planning process for the Central Yukon Plan, which we've been told may be completed by the end of this year. If they make a recommendation to lift significant portions of that public land order, the state has top filed selections, which means that we're essentially hovering over those public land orders, and then those become selections, and then the state then could bring those lands in. There's probably approximately 1 million acres of land within that TAPS corridor for both access and mineral rights, as well as to kick off to possibly an Ambler Road. Those are all important assets within there. We continue to also bring in former federal mining claims that are essentially holes in the state's title. Say, for example, the state had brought in a township of land. You may have a couple hundred acres that would have been a federal mining claim that was essentially a donut hole within our title, that quite often there's still interest in us bringing that into ownership. Quite often there's still minerals there and federal miners that desire to continue to develop those lands. So we continue to work that issue every day. It's an important issue.
Any follow-up? Thank you. Okay, I think we had Representative Hannon and then Rauscher and then Sponholz.
I'm on the next slide.
So oh, okay. Representative Rauscher, thank you.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, through the Chair. I was wondering, in your slide 14 was what we just covered here, the top bulletin on the right, basically it talks about some rivers there, which we own land beneath, and it has at least one or more of the rivers which we actually allow equipment to go in and keep the direction of the river away from roads and other. I was wondering, one time we used to be able to actually extract gravel out of the rivers and sell it. The Matanuska comes in my mind. Is that possible now? And if it isn't, how come? And if it is, how can that happen? And I was wondering, are we even looking toward being able to do that as a state anymore? And if not, why?
Through the Chair, Representative Rauscher.
Sorry to put it all out that way.
We'll see if we can unpack that. If the state owns the submerged lands beneath the navigable water body, then the state is able to issue authorizations for various activities. What would need to happen is some sort of application or plan would need to come forward from an applicant to do said activities, and then the state could be in dialogue about how that might be, as well as a public process that would likely go forward with an application like that. So I would say that there's potential to be able to move forward on that front. The state would simply need to receive an application and essentially a plan that could be communicated to the public on what's the intended activity and what it would entail.
Follow-up question?
Mm-hmm.
And this may not be related exactly to that, but I could see in the next slide we're going to move on. So I guess what I'm wondering about is permitting right now for projects and contracts. Some of them have been put in, and they're reaching their two-year lifespan, and that means they're going to have to be put in again. And I'm just wondering, are there a lot of those, and are we going to be able to address those more efficiently in the future, if you know what I'm saying. I know I can, there are actually three permits I know in my district, which are now about ready to expire in March, and they have no confirmation one way or the other. So these are kind of important to people in my district, contractors that are going to want to do projects this summer, moving forward in the, so I was wondering, can you address that situation for us?
Through the chair, Representative Rauscher, I'd be happy to work with you on those specific situations, but the department is continuing to work on its permitting and making it as effective and efficient as possible.
I understand that. Okay, I appreciate it if we could, because I know those are going to, and it could be another 2 years, and then they have to reapply, and then the costs involved there. So I appreciate your considering that to talk to me about them. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Sure. Representative Hannon.
Can we go back to abandoned and derelict vessels? Thank you for the work on the Accutan, but I know that last year some legislation was passed to set up a fund to try and address the perhaps thousands of vessels. And I'm wondering whether, one, we have an inventory or an estimated cost to clean up the derelict vessels and abandoned vessels problem spread across Alaska.
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, that is a very large body of work. We do have some lists of some known abandoned and derelict vessels. The amount of money required to address that issue is quite substantial, and the legislation that was passed last year, Senate Bill 92, was just about to try and begin to collect just a little bit of money based upon registration of certain vessels. That was the first step in a direction that needs to take place. There's many more steps to truly address that issue, and we've got a long ways to go within this state. So I think we need to continue to work with you to find solutions. And I'm trying to think if there's another question in there that I've not yet answered.
Follow-up?
Can you, this is perhaps for someone else in the department, but is that stream of money that was allocated last year to begin acquiring the endless pot that will be needed, is it still intact, or has that been redirected with some of the budgetary redirections that we've seen?
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, to my knowledge, the tap on that hasn't started, so money hasn't yet started being collected, and my understanding is it potentially is listed in a number of possible funds that may be swept based upon legislation either yet to be introduced by this administration.
Thank you. Representative Sponholz.
Thanks, Chair Tarr. I have a very easy softball for you. Could you just reiterate the number of acres that we have not received from the federal government that we were promised upon statehood?
Through the chair, Representative Sponholz, approximately 5.3 million acres. In excess of that, the state is still owed.
Thanks.
Representative Tallarico.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Deputy Commissioner, back to the municipal land entitlements. I haven't followed it really closely. Do we still have any of the municipalities completely finished their municipal selections, or are there still some that have municipal selections kind of hovering out there?
Right. Through the chair, Representative Tallarico, there are some bureaus and municipalities that have completed their land entitlement. There are others that are still due. I do have a sheet that I can provide to the committee that lists all of those entities, their calculated entitlement, and what's been conveyed from the state to those, and I can make that available to the committee.
Okay, that'd be great. And just a brief follow-up: Are some of the municipal selections over top of some of our state selections that are on top of the federal land that we haven't received yet, or have we run into that situation?
Through the chair, Representative Tallarico, I'm uncertain if some of those municipal or bureau entitlements are selecting lands that aren't yet in the state ownership, but I'll get you an answer on that.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mm-hmm. Representative Cannon.
That rattles my cage. Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair, at least via rumor, the recording office here in Juneau is going to be shut down in this fiscal year. Are other recording offices across the state being shut? Will we have only one in Anchorage, or what's the status of recording offices?
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, that's in another division. I can talk to that a little bit, but I also have the director of that division in the room. But within the current budget, there's proposals to close four satellite recording districts. That would leave Anchorage as the sole recording district, which would be relying upon e-recording. E-recording is electronic recording that the state has been doing for a number of years and has been doing successfully. It has reduced cost and money, but we can talk about that more if you would like at a later date.
Sure. Yeah.
All right. Am I on to another division?
I think so.
All right. Very good. Thank you. Rock and roll. The Division of Forestry is led by the state forester, Chris Mache. He has about 236 individuals within the division. They're the lead state agency for fighting wildfire on about 150 million acres throughout the state. In 2018, they responded to 203 fires that burned just over 46,000 acres. And the one year I want to compare it with is in calendar year 2015. 2015 was the worst year for acreage when over 5.1 million acres of lands burned. That's a hundredfold what we experienced last year. And there were 76 fires, or 766 fires that they ended up fighting in 2015. Also in 2018, the Division of Forestry sold 7.9 million board feet of logs in 22 lumber sales to 15 Alaska-based companies.
And I'm just wondering, on the staffing, that's largely the summer crews for fire response, that 236 number. The year-round folks would probably be a lot fewer. Do we know?
Madam Chair, I do know that they train in excess of 1,000 individuals, firefighters, you know, as they work up here in the spring. And so my understanding is that that is the permanent number of staff within the Division of Forestry. And they do hire, or they do train in excess of 1,000 folks every year to fight fires.
Wow. Okay. Thank you.
In 2018, to speak to your Alaska hire, they over 96% are Alaska hire within our firefighting capacity. And again, there's that number for the number of folks that were trained, 1,168 last year. Their efforts generated $1.4 million in local vendor contracts during the fire season. The bottom bullet there on the left, the Forest Division of Forestry signed a second Good Neighbor Authority contract, and that was recently completed. It was a $2.1 million sale, which was a mix of 16 million board feet of both state and federal volume here in Southeast. The division continues to work on a couple other long-term, which would be 10-year sales that are important to continued industry here in Southeast, as well as the roadless rulemaking effort that the state is a cooperating agency on. I do believe that the state forester, Chris Mache, will be here on Friday talking about a forestry update. In addition to many of those topics, I know that many of the districts in the central part of the state have been infested by the bark beetle, and Chris is going to bring a lot of information about that and what the state's been doing. I do know that they've done significant outreach. They've had over 9 public workshops, 19 presentations. They have another 6 presentations, I think, scheduled in 2019. But I know Chris will be prepared to share more of that information on Friday when he's with you.
Thank you. Representative Hannon.
Thank you, through the chair. I apologize for the freshman learning curve that you're having to suffer through. Could you tell me what makes something a good neighbor authority agreement as opposed to a bad neighbor or standard neighbor? Or I assume it's
sure.
A term from the industry, but I don't know what it means.
Through the chair, Representative Hannon. It's actually a program that's a federal program. It's from the Department of Agriculture, and it allows state agencies often to take the lead and do much of the work on potential timber sales that include federal lands. And so it was instituted a couple years back. I know Idaho has used it successfully. Alaska, again, this is our second one of doing this. And so it allows the state agency to take the lead on the selling of federal timber in some locations. And I'm sure Chris can give you more on Friday. He'd be happy to talk more about that.
Okay, please continue.
Thank you. The Division of Parks and Outdoor Recreation has 164 positions and is led by Director Ricky Geese. The state of Alaska has the largest state park system in the United States, 3.3 million acres, the largest park being Wood-Tik-Chik State Park, which is approximately or approaching almost 1.6 million acres. There are about 160 park units within the state and 900 miles of hiking trails. The division also administers federal recreational trail grants and statewide programs for boating safety and historic preservation. The one program I'll highlight here on this page is the Kids Don't Float program. Since that program's inception, it's been responsible or credited for saving at least 32 lives to date. And so that's a really important program. And they do some really tremendous outreach within the schools. In 2018, the division completed the Eagle Rock unit facility facelift, and that's that probably second picture down closest to the words on the page there. That's along the Kenai River. They also completed the 140-foot suspension bridge at Byers Lake, and that's the top right photo that you see there. That helps improve recreational and hunter access in that area. The Division of Parks continues to be innovative in finding ways to reduce their reliance on general funds. In 2018, they also provided almost 4,000 loaner life jackets. If you've been out in the state at many different places, at many different boat launches or whatever, you'll see these life jackets that are hanging in lots of places, so that if people don't have them, they're encouraged to borrow one and put it to use and then return it. But it's a really valuable tool. We've been out in the field, and we've even had a member of our team borrow a life jacket just because it didn't end up in the vehicle somehow. But anyway, that's a wonderful program to help increase awareness and saves people lives. They continue to foster economic development by they've issued 40 archaeological survey permits. And they reviewed over 2,000 projects for impacts to historic properties. Last year, they granted over $1.4 million in recreational grants. That's primarily a capital project that deals with summer and winter trails. Those trails help promote use of safe, legal, well-maintained trail networks and discourage trespass onto other properties. All right. Division of Agriculture. Acting Director Dave Shady is at the lead there, and they have 33 positions. The Division of Ag provides land sales, loans, inspections, the Alaska Grown Program, and other essential programs to the agricultural industry. The Plants Material Center, which is located out in Palmer, provides the sole source of plant material developed for Alaska's unique environment, protecting Alaska from resources from invasive species. Many of our projects, whether they're road projects or other ones, require reclamation, and it's important to have Alaska-grown clean seed that can be used in those. Those seeds are best for our environment, and they discourage the introduction of invasives, whether they're upland or terrestrial. Those are really important. So Division of Ag is very important with regards to that. The division launched its first international trade effort last year in order to open up world markets to more Alaska products, and so we were excited about that. They leveraged $1.8 million in grant funding for agricultural industry, and in 2019 they're looking to leverage close to $5 million in federal grants. The 2018 Farm Bill had a provision that provides for $4 million a year for 4 years, in microgrants that's available to the state of Alaska. And so that's one thing now that they're busy working on, leveraging that. One of the examples of how the Division of Ag is helping introduce products into different markets, the Anchorage School District last year purchased over 750,000 pounds of Alaska-grown products. And that's not only good for the farm industry, it's good for our kids as well. So we're excited about that. The Agriculture Revolving Loan Fund promotes the development of agriculture via moderate interest loan rates. It manages over $7 million in loans spread out over about 55 active loans that are out there today. The plant material sale, conditioned over 165,000 pounds of native seed. Again, that's really critical for reclamation activities within the state. They inspected approximately $100 million in timber and other agricultural products that were exported. And the division continues to do great work on invasives, whether they're working closely with ADF&G, Fish and Game on Elodia, or other invasives such as Canada thistle and orange hawkweed.
We have a couple questions. Representative Rauscher, yes. And then Hopkins.
Yeah, thank you very much. Through the chair, it says you're talking about timber. Where do we export our timber to right now? Do you know?
Through the chair, Representative Rauscher, in previous years, some of our timber has made its way over to Korea. And so it's predominantly Southeast Asia is where much of our raw timber is destined for there.
And through a follow-up, Lower 48 anywhere?
Through the chair, I'm not certain. Chris Mace, who will be here on Friday, would probably be the best person to explain that. I don't know if the cost of shipping it down there makes it
prohibitive.
Prohibitive, yes.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
And folks may not be aware, and I'll just make a quick comment now, that Commissioner-designee Feige was not available for Friday. And because the schedule is already out, we couldn't schedule a bill or anything, but we're going to have the forestry update. And so that's what he's referring to, but that might not be well known to folks just yet, because that's been in the last couple days that we had to make that change. Next, we have Representative Hopkins and then Representative Rasmussen.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Can I get a update sort of on the Elodia-infested work, the Elodia reclamation work, trying to get rid of that, and where you've seen success and also where the next targets might be?
Sure. And through the chair, Representative Hopkins, what I may do is ask Rob Carter. Is Rob Carter on the phone? Mm-hmm. I think he's going to have a bit more specifics than I could give you off the top of my head. So please help, Rob.
Lifeline to you, Mr. Carter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is Rob Carter, the Division of Ag in Palmer, for the record. Through the chair, Representative, we have continued to see some wider distribution of Elodia. Of course, we all know that the only two known infestations in the Mat-Su are in the Alexander Lake drainage area and Sucker Lake complex. We have a new infestation that was recently found this last fall in Jewel Lake of Anchorage. We're continually monitoring Anchorage Lakes such as DeLong, Little Campbell, Sand Lake. We're actively managing Little Survival, better known as Potter's Marsh, and Lake Hood. A lot of those lakes currently have no Elodia found after management and treatment. We're continuing to monitor those lakes for species. We've had, through our partnerships with Fish and Game and Fish and Wildlife Service and in the boroughs, we've had excellent success with those partners, and Elodia at this time has been eradicated from the Kenai Peninsula, No Name Lake, Daniels Lake, Sport Lake. And so at this time, we are analyzing vectors to other lakes. Of course, there's a lot of water bodies in the state of Alaska that we need to evaluate for potential Elodia. There's Chena Slough in the Fairbanks region, which has been under active management. A new find there at the Manly Slough, Bathing Beauty Pond, and I believe Quartz Lake, just outside of Delta.
Thank you, and I'm mostly concerned about that Fairbanks interior area, as that's my home turf. And I know the Chena Slough was being looked at about 10 years ago or so. It's still under active management. And then is there anything in the Clearwater, and have we had any indications of it expanding into the Tanana River at all, into the Chena River itself outside of that slough?
Through the chair, for the record, this is Rob Carter, the Division of Ag. Through the chair, Representative, you are correct. In the interior, we have been actively managing Chena Slough in partnership with the Fairbanks Soil and Water Conservation. It looks fantastic from the management activities in the last year, a few spot treatment follow-ups and continued surveys to make sure that that population is under control. Nothing in the Clearwater at this time, but we have identified along the Tanana drainage at Manly Slough and the Tolchakit Slough closer to Nanana.
Thank you very much.
Representative Rasmussen.
Yes, so I have a couple questions. The first one I'll direct to, I'm not sure who's on the phone right now, I can't remember his name.
Mr. Carter.
Carter, yes, thank you. So I represent Sand Lake area, which includes Jewel Lake, part of DeLong Lake, probably Little Campbell and Sand Lake. And I'm just curious, as you guys are following this, is part of the problem, I know several of those lakes have a lot of humans going in the lakes to swim. So is there, I mean, is that part of the problem? Or is there something that we're looking at to address this so it doesn't happen again in the future in those lakes?
For the record, this is Rob Carter, through the chair. Representative, yes, those lakes, vectors in those lakes tend to be, from our hypothesis, is fish tanks. Float plane traffic or boat and trailer traffic. We are working hard to educate the public in the community through signage with Fish and Game to make sure people understand first what the Elodea looks like, that it's illegal to dump a fish tank into a water body in the state of Alaska, and then, of course, actively manage those invasive populations to then reduce that transfer, that vector to other water bodies within the community.
So it's not directly related to humans getting in and swimming in the water. Okay. I have.
For the record, this is Rob Carter. Through the chair, Representative, no, Elodea at this point hasn't been human vectored unless it's been, you know, purposely moved or dumped unknowingly into a water body.
I did have one more question about timber. Unfortunately, I won't be here on Friday, but do we have any local processing facilities for timber? Because I know that the price of lumber for builders has gone up pretty substantially in the last year or two, and the cost of housing is very high here in Alaska. So is there anything, do we have anything like that where we could try to keep more timber in Alaska?
If possible, if we could go to Chris Mache to speak about some of those capabilities, that'd be great.
Mr. Mache?
Yeah, hi, this is Chris Mache, Director of Division of Forestry for the record, through the chair, Representative. Depends on the part of the state you live in. There are several mills, many mills actually statewide, that produce what we call domestic lumber, particularly in the interior. Northland Wood is the biggest mill up in Fairbanks. There's several other mills in Tok, Delta, and other communities are along the rail belt and the road system, and then several smaller mills on the Kenai and in the Anchorage areas.
Thank you.
Okay. I just want to make a comment. This is an area where we've been spending a lot of time in developing our agriculture opportunity. Several people have a strong interest in this, and I know when we get in the budget conversation, we'll be looking at this in more detail because there are quite a number of positions cut, including the Alaska Grown Program and the Plant Materials Center that Mr. Carter works at. So I'm thankful that you're here showing us the value of these facilities and the work that they're doing for our economy and for food security. And just want to kind of benchmark that here, or, you know, mention that so that when we come back to that conversation, we're kind of thinking of these things because we have really what I think is unlimited opportunity and so much interest, and we'll of course spend more time talking about some of the more recent developments with farmers markets and things like that, but just a lot of really positive things happening for agriculture in Alaska, and so hopefully we'll be able to do what we can to keep the right people in place to keep that, you know, positive momentum going forward.
Absolutely. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mm-hmm. Anyone else?
Representative
Tallarico.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wondered, with our Plant Materials Center, and I don't know, maybe it's a silly question, Department of the Interior and National Park Service, are they one of our customers and clients when they do some substantial purchases from us?
Probably Rob Carter would know if we've sold to the Park Service.
For the record, this is Rob Carter. Through the chair, Representative, yes, we've sold to countless federal agencies and departments and divisions with those agencies in some small quantities. The private sector of the native seed production in Alaska has sold significant quantities of material that had been developed here for Alaska's unique growing conditions and then, of course, processed and tested here for use on those federal lands.
Okay, thank you. And not necessarily a follow-up, but I just know that the Park Service on an annual basis asks for droves of volunteers to pluck invasive species from the sides of their road. So if they don't use all of our material from the Materials Center, I would suggest to them they do. Because I think our seeds are pretty clean, and when I'm just suspicious when they're asking for volunteers to remove invasive species, I think it would be appropriate for them to use our good, clean seed here on every project they do. Just a statement. Thank you.
Yeah, no, agree with that statement. Thank you. Anyone else? Okay, please continue.
All right, the last division that I'm going to share with you today, definitely not least, is the Support Services Division. Within the room, we've got Director Fabian Peter Contes. The division's got 71 personnel. It has a massive undertaking of managing and providing the state lands record management for how we take care of and make decisions on our 160 million acres of state land. They also provide the geospatial information system support, which is really important to our adjudicators and managers as they're making decisions for use of state land and water. The division also oversees our procurement, our budget, our financial transactions, and ensures public funds from 20 different sources are managed with integrity and transparency. Human resources is another service that they provide as well. In 2018, they transitioned the travel services to Shared Services of Alaska, and so we're still evaluating how that went. We've provided technology services in the creation of a statewide GIS geoportal, and for your knowledge, that's going to be housed within our Division of Geologic and Geophysical Survey within the Alaska Geodetic Council, and so it's a portal of portals that you can go and check that out. Lastly, the division worked hard to help reduce our workspace footprint within Anchorage and Fairbanks in order to continue to drive some of our operating costs down. But that group does a lot of tremendous work for the division and the department, and so I'm open to some other questions if you have any.
Thank you. I do want to ask, just so I understand organizationally, that the change here, it looks like, so admin services has gone away, and is support services the sort of equivalent under the new organization? Am I missing that?
Madam Chair, through the chair, to my knowledge, it's the last several years it's been the Support Services Division.
Okay.
You may have seen that the admin support directors, like Director Fabian Peter Contes is now dual-hatted between the Department of Natural Resources and the Office of Management and Budget. So she gets to wear two hats most every day. Okay. But the Support Services Division, to my knowledge, has been that for quite some time.
Okay, I was not remembering. Thank you so much. And I'm going to be putting you on the spot, but could you, Director Peter Contes, just share with us a little bit what that means in terms of, you know, prior years, difference, reorganization in terms of the work? Thank you.
Good afternoon. For the record, Fabian Peter Contess, Director of Support Services for the Department of Natural Resources and the Office of Management and Budget. It's a mouthful. Just to answer your question, Chair Tarr, Support Services Division was named such because we have a little bit of a unique mission, which is threefold. Administrative services, very traditional backbone support of, you know, human resources, budget, procurement, financial management. And we have two other pieces, which was traditionally information technology, including GIS. And as you know, a significant portion of our information technology group was transferred to the Office of Information Technology in 2018, excuse me. So we have kept the GIS portion, which I still oversee. And then the third leg of the stool, I guess, is the State Recorder's Office. And so those three entities are under our division, which is why you'll probably see this is the only division, administrative-like division in the state that is named Support Services rather than Administrative Services. To answer your second question, which is the two hats that I currently wear, I have to say that there's some incredible benefits to being in the same room and the same table with my counterparts across the state. We have always worked well as a team. We've met regularly. We make decisions or we recommend decisions to the Office of Management and Budget and to the Division of Personnel, to all of the backbone infrastructure that we have in support of our state services. But this move has actually forced some very, very good conversations, and I believe that as we move forward, we're going to be setting up task forces to try to address the bigger issues that the state has with, and I'm just going to name a couple things. We have kind of a chronic issue with payroll, for example. We have a system that is difficult. We have union contracts that are inconsistent. We have an odd way of paying twice a month instead of every 2 weeks, which causes some problems. We're going to put a task force of administrative services directors together, as well as the experts in those fields, to try to tackle these large problems that that create an amazing amount of inefficiency and frustration. So those, in those areas, it's very exciting. I think it's an opportunity for us to make a difference statewide on a lot of different levels. At the same time, I'm still embedded in the Department of Natural Resources, which is, you know, the agency I love, and I still get to work with the amazing leadership team, the directors and the deputy commissioners, and our new commissioner, Corey Feige, commissioner designee. So does that answer your question?
Sure. That's very helpful, and it's exciting to hear these innovations that are happening as a result of everybody working together, and hopefully keep us posted on those things. And just, with this being our first meeting, kind of just trying to understand what the department looks like and if there have been changes and what that, you know, kind of means. So that was helpful for me. I don't know if anybody, Representative Rasmussen.
So I did have a question about the recorder's office. Is that under your jurisdiction? Okay.
Yes, it is.
So if we're shifting to the e-recording, do you have any idea as far as kind of what type of savings we're looking at? And then is there going to be additional turnaround time? I know typically it's 24 hours for a recording. Is that going to delay the process at all?
Through the chair, Representative Rasmussen, without getting too far into the budget details, I certainly could, but there is a proposal in the governor's amended budget to reduce the recorder's office by $408,000 by closing four offices, Kenai, Palmer, Juneau, and Fairbanks, and do all recording in the Anchorage office. Currently, we have approximately 50 60% of our documents are electronically recorded. Mm-hmm. The other documents are either walk-ins or mail-ins. That type of work can be done anywhere. We are reducing the number of staff in this proposal, but we're also moving the staff that's necessary to continue recording to the Anchorage office as well. So we don't anticipate there's going to be any slowdown to electronic recording. There is going to be a reduction in service when somebody wants to walk into an office. However, we are still have all of our documents available electronically online, and we're looking at other ways to mitigate some impacts in certain areas.
Any follow-up? Thank you. And just on that, because I'm not as familiar, so if I'm an individual that needs that service, and then I live in Juneau, and there's no longer the walk-in option, would I just call on the phone, and then I would send documents electronically, they'd be recorded, it'd all be electronic communication and recorded that way? Is that how that would work? Or?
Chair Tarr, there's a couple ways you could record. You could actually go to a title company who is using electronic recording, e-recording, mm-hmm. and ask them to record for you.
Okay.
And they will pay. You will be charged a fee that you will pay the title company, because the title company is paying a company called Simplifile for this service. Simplifile interfaces with the Department of Natural Resources in our recording system. And you'd also pay the recording fee. Mm-hmm. So you could pay a little, you could pay for that, or you can mail your document in to any. Maybe you'd be mailing it into Anchorage if the budget proposal moves forward.
Okay. Quick, I have one follow-up mm-hmm. to that. Okay. So I'm very familiar with the recorder's office through real estate. Are there any other transactions that go through the recorder's office aside from residential or, you know, state or federal recordings?
Representative Rasmussen, through the chair, yes, there are many. There are plat files that are used for, you know, we are required to keep the original plat files. So we have a significant number of large file cabinets that keep plats for residential areas, municipalities, et cetera. Liens are recorded. Child support enforcement liens are recorded. There are, of course, the real estate transactions. And there's also the mining affidavits of labor that are recorded. Those are to name a few. You can basically record anything as long as it meets the criteria of the basic criteria of formatting.
One more quick.
We don't encourage that, but
yeah. So for you keeping a hard, are you saying you have to keep a hard copy of all plat files? Is that a statute or a regulatory? Or is that electronic?
Representative Rasmussen, through the chair, I'm not sure if it's if it's statutory or regulatory, but we are required to keep the plat file originals. Mm-hmm. And if somebody comes, for instance, a developer comes, they can check out a copy of the plat file, and we keep a marker in the plat file to make sure that we know that the document is out, and then any changes to those plats are done on the original. Every other document is kept only long enough to record it. So if somebody mails a document in, this is not electronic recording, but if somebody mails a document in, we keep it only long enough to record it and to verify that the microfilm backup is accurate. So, for instance, if it gets recorded, we look at the microfilm several days later, and we don't have a clear copy, we can scan it again before we send the originals back. We only keep microfilm of other documents, and that's a national standard.
Okay. One more follow-up, sorry. Yeah. Are all those files currently kept in Anchorage?
Representative Rasmussen, through the chair, many of the files are kept in Anchorage. There are some files that are still kept in Fairbanks and Juneau. I'm reaching the limit of my detailed knowledge. So, but there are some still in different locations.
In theory, would it require more space than in Anchorage to hold all of these files that are required?
Representative Rasmussen, through the chair, yes. And we are looking right now at, number one, space, mm-hmm. and number two, cabinets that actually are more efficient in storage, because these plat files, as you can imagine, take up a significant amount of space. So we're looking at that to minimize footprint and cost.
Thank you.
Representative Hannon.
Thank you, and through the chair, I guess since we're going there in the recorder's office, I am one of those people that have this visual memory and understanding of the recorder's office having the big plat files, and foreseeing that since the bulk of this is going to be done electronically, that a computer programmer says recording titles is an easy thing and it looks like this. And for a vast majority of the daily task, it probably is pretty straightforward. But we know that Alaska has this diverse history of mining plats regionally applied and liens being filed. And I just foresee that the computer guys designing it, and probably use, you know, the computer staffing, not really visualizing the diversity of demands that we're going to have. And it's going to be the person in the remote location looking for the mine plat that no longer exists and they can't find, and the computer can't show it to them in one screen. It's going to be 47 screens to do, and go ahead and print them out and tape them together yourself, and you're not going to get the alignment. And I just see it being a place where we're going to have Alaskans in the most remote locations, the absolutely most frustrated and stymied by this efficiency. And I just have to say that, because that's what I visualize being the problems when people go, it sounds good on paper that we're going to streamline it, make it super efficient, and it will be for certain aspects of recording. But there are other parts of recording that it just seems like there isn't a way to take the massive platting of Alaska and make it more efficient by putting it all in one place.
Plus, people are going to need a one-on-one on how to navigate DNR, because it's kind of confusing looking at the recorder's office.
And you do it for a living.
Time. Yeah.
Do you want to comment on that at all or have any thoughts? I don't know if you want to.
Representative Hannon, through the chair, I mean, I think it was a statement more than a question, and I will address it as such. We realize that having a walk-in office is the best possible scenario. Many of us want to do in person. We get that. We have concerns about the mining community. Typically, we have many of the mining community, they don't have access to computers, or they're not familiar with it. They prefer to walk in. We have a great staff in the recorder's office who go the extra mile to help people when they walk in the door. We are looking at the most important programs and how we meet the mission of the agency. Are these offices great? Absolutely. I support them. Can we afford them in this day and age? Are they the most efficient use of the dollars that we bring in to the state of Alaska? That's a decision that we all have to make. I would like to quote, was it Representative or Senator Schauer? It's a nice to have, maybe not a must have. Mm-hmm.
Any further thoughts? Okay, Representative Sponholz.
Thank you, Chair Tarr. I'm a little bit confused, because I just made a note earlier that you said that plat files, we were required to have a hard copy on file to hold on to hard copies by either statute or regulation. It wasn't clear which one. Did you say that we're exploring going digital? Did I miss something?
Representative Sponholz, through the chair, we are required to keep original plat files. I don't believe we are going to go electronic with plat files. We do have them available electronically, but those are something that the document of record is in Mylar.
Mm-hmm. Sure. That's helpful because I think it means that we'll still continue to have a lot of those documents, which we need to have in their original yes. format. I will also just make the comment because we sometimes use the word efficiency and suggest that efficiency, which is really a ratio of value and cost as like the ultimate measure of performance, when in fact that's not always the ultimate measure of performance. Sometimes the ultimate measure of performance is customer service and meeting the objective, you know, for the clientele that's being served. And so, you know, it sounds like in the case of plat files, it's probably still best for us to continue to have those hard copy files there. And I just want to put out there that efficiency is not the gold standard always. It's something that it's important to aspire to, and we should think about it. But you can't look at efficiency without also questioning what the deliverable is and make sure that efficiency doesn't mar the quality of the product that we're trying to deliver to the community. And government, in the example of the recording offices, provides provides an essential service on which, you know, all of our economy operates on. And so it's important that we have good customer service as well as efficiency. Thanks.
One comment for that.
Sure.
Okay.
Representative Rasmussen.
I use the recorder's office hundreds of times a year, probably 800 times a year, the website. So I will say that for people that don't understand it or know how to use it, it can be a little bit confusing at first, but after you've learned it, it is fairly easy to navigate. I've never once stepped foot inside of the recorder's office physically, so I don't know the necessity of it, but I think that we would definitely want to educate people on the alternative resources that are out there as part of the transition, such as a title company that can help people with the e-recording process, because I mean, a person doing a process on their own may not be aware of a title company, for example, and the fees are very affordable for the services that they're providing. So if we're looking at $500,000 for education or $500,000 for the recording office.
And we will be looking at all those things in the coming weeks. Are there any other comments on the recorder's office? I just wanted to go back and just have a question. When we're looking at right now, each of these divisions, we've listed, for example, the number of staff. And this would be under the FY19 management plan number of staff, and these are all filled positions at this time, or these are the number of management plan staff authorized under that division?
Madam Chair, they are budgeted positions in the fiscal year 19 budget plan.
Okay. And just as a follow-up to that, wondering, with so much sort of uncertainty around some of these positions and that perhaps even the division, whether it will continue on into the future, are you seeing folks leaving the department at all, or are you seeing any seeing things that are concerning you in that way, or having trouble hiring? We know, for example, with the troopers, we are in this crisis situation where we have these many unfilled positions and, you know, trying to unravel sort of what are the reasons that that's happening. Are we seeing anything on the DNR side and any concerns about losing the quality staff? Because some of these are more specialized positions. And I guess I just have concerns, you know, it's not always that person can be so easily replaced. And, you know, just want to make sure we don't lose some of these key people in places that would slow us down on projects and things like that.
I'll lead out real quick.
This is
Brent Goodrum. A stable and predictable budget is one of the most important things to retention. When there's uncertainty, you have members of the workforce that, you know, it's concerning, and they're concerned for their well-being, their family's well-being, their ability to provide. And so when people get concerned, quite often they look elsewhere. And so our ability to attract and retain quality skilled folks to do the work of the state, it becomes a very challenging situation. And it's been tough over the last several years for most any department. But one of the things that's most important is if we can get to a stable and predictable budget, mm-hmm. that puts a kind of a solid foundation where people can feel comfortable in what they're doing and know that the work that they're doing is going to continue to be there and they continue to progress and do other things. But vacancies is a really important issue. When you lose an employee, it often takes you several months if you're able to begin to step through the process to begin to go out and start the process. If it's a revenue generating position that you can justify the ability to go and recruit, then when you go to do that, to get someone on board and then to train them and get them up to speed, that is all lost capacity that the department has when you have those vacancies. And so it's a very real and important issue, not only to the Department of Natural Resources, but to other departments as well. And I think Fabian may have one other comment to add.
For the record, Fabian Peter Contess. Couple things on positions. I think, Chair Tarr, you had asked about the Division of Forestry positions, and that number was 260 mm-hmm, mm-hmm. something. And that is permanent full-time and a permanent seasonal position. So it's not all permanent full-time. Just wanted to clarify that. Mm-hmm. And in addition to that, there are the emergency firefighters that we hire and the hotshot crews, the three crews that we hire for firefighting. Just in terms of positions, I don't have all the details by the division with me, but management plan numbers, we have 901 positions. Of those, 624 are permanent full-time. And of those 624, 56 are currently vacant. Well, okay, they were vacant as of 1/31, January 31st.
Okay.
And to tag on to what Brent was talking about, there are certain areas where we have more difficulty recruiting, and forestry is one of them. Foresters in particular. Mm-hmm. Director Chris Mache can certainly talk in more specifics if you'd like when you talk to him on Friday, but that has been an area that has been chronically difficult to recruit and retain. Mm-hmm. And those are the folks that lead into the leadership of the division. They move up into the leadership. So that's been a bit of a struggle for Division of Forestry. The other area that we're starting to see an uptick in oil and gas industry hires. Mm-hmm. So we are competing, the state is competing with the private sector for oil and gas positions and expertise. And this committee is well aware that the state cannot compete salary-wise with the private sector when there are those jobs out there. So that's another specific area. If you want details about other divisions, we can certainly get that for you.
Thank you. That's really helpful. I just wanted to have those numbers in my mind. And, of course, on Monday we're going to start with the real thorough budget presentations and really going through things in greater detail, but just kind of some big picture thinking of what those numbers meant today. That was super helpful for me. Mm-hmm. I don't know if anybody has any other questions. We're all done. I was just going to comment, we are working on some legislation related to invasive species that I hope will be of interest. I know it's several people have issues in their area, and we'll share that, and hopefully that could be more like a committee priority for folks. In terms of follow-up, there are just a couple things I wanted to mention. We had the two earlier items before Deputy Commissioner Longan left on the map of common carrier pipelines and the audit trend for 5 years. Then with your presentation, Mr. Deputy Commissioner Goodrum, the land conveyances, that information was requested, and then it sounds like there had been some requests on the e-recording, but that was prior to that more lengthy exchange. So I don't know if there are any other questions on the e-recording or if we got to cover those here in committee, but the land conveyance information. And if you could, what didn't get mentioned was with Representative Tallarico's question, there's also the native selections overlay, the municipal and the state. So if there's any information to help us understand sort of that blended piece, because I know our congressional delegation has been trying to work on some of those issues as well, and that might help help us all understand that a little bit better. Was there anything I missed in terms of follow-up that people wanted? Okay. Before we go, a couple things. Wanted to thank, if you noticed, this new beautiful painting, and that is Red Dog Mine from our co-chair's neck of the woods. We have been loaned that by Nana, and so wanted to say thank you to them for loaning us that to add to our wall here. And the earlier mention of the program guide that you started out talking about, we have posted that on BASIS, so it should be easily found if you would like to read that. So I don't know if you have any closing comments for us before we wrap up.
Madam Chair, we're just excited to be here working with you this year. Commissioner Feige, again, sends her regrets today. She's at the Permanent Fund board meeting all day, but she looks forward to being with you next week, and it should be a great year. We look forward to sharing as much information as we can with this group because we know how important these decisions are for our state. So thank you for the opportunity to give you the overview today.
Thank you. We really appreciated that. And with no further business before the committee, we'll go ahead and adjourn at 2:41 p.m. Thank you, everyone.